You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to the Ready Room, show number 39, A Fistful of T'Pol's. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Greg Harbin. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including new fine art prints from Bye Bye Robot, new Trek goods for your kitchen, Entrada's extended Star Trek VI soundtrack release, STO's The 2800, March events celebrating Ricardo Montalban and Khan, and some mysterious happenings in London. Then in the feature, we're joined by Michael Fisher as we discuss the Enterprise episode Carbon Creek. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Greg. How are you this week?
Chris, I am doing actually pretty well. I just went out and went to Target and spent way too much money, but I now have a rice machine, which is very important, a rice cooker. I have a electric kettle for making tea and coffee, and most importantly, I have a toaster. I have a toaster now in my kitchen. It does not have a machine gun. It is very friendly.
Oh, you didn't get the machine gun attachment.
I thought about it. I thought about, you know, they have the Centurion model, but I went with more of an easier to get along with toaster. You know, we chat, we have conversations, we get along. You know, the Centurions just, they have that angry red eye pulsing back and forth.
Yeah.
I couldn't deal with it.
I saw the commercials. You know, it's that new company, Fracken, that makes that. And
Swedish, right?
Yeah, sounds Swedish. Well, good. It sounds like you're getting all situated there.
Yeah, so things are coming together. How about for you, Chris? How was your week?
That was a busy one here. You know, yesterday we were at SoftBank getting our son his first cell phone.
Oh, wow.
And boy, talk about something to make you feel old as a parent is when you go to get your kids their first cell phone. And I was thinking, in Star Trek, what is it like for parents in Starfleet when their kids get their first communicator? Like when Naomi Wildman was a baby, and then she grows up, she gets her first communicator. You got to feel like, oh, my little baby's just growing up now.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, do they have the little Starfleet insignia, K-Tai, in Japan now? I know they're ahead of everyone else.
No, don't have that one, unfortunately. It's hard to get anything Star Trek over here. You know, I want a Star Trek iPhone case. I'm going to actually make my own because
nice.
The best I can do is order them from ThinkGeek in the U.S., which would be fine, but, you know, the case costs like $15 and the shipping is like $38, so I can't justify it.
I went into a Kinokuniya here in Seattle. It's a Japanese bookstore, but there was one here, and yeah, they had a ton of Star Trek stuff. I don't know what the deal is. Like, they think Japan, Star Trek's big in Japan, so they better stock it up here. Or maybe people just think that, but there was like Star Trek books, Star Trek toys, Star Trek wallets. But go to Japan itself and try to find anything Star Trek related, and good luck with that.
Yeah. They're just catering to the audience there.
Yeah, probably. Also, you can get an $80 Totoro stuffed animal, which I was this close to actually purchasing.
And that sounds expensive there, but here, if that were 8 or 9,000 yen, you would just think, that's
exactly
about right.
Yes.
So, well, speaking of international things, Greg, as we jump into the Star Trek news here, this is a quick story. We really don't know what's going on yet, but StarTrek.com. posted the other day, is London ready for Star Trek? And it just says that something big is arriving in London and all Star Trek fans will want to be part of it. And there's a website where you can go sign up. It's StarTrekLondon.com, and you can be the first to know when the details are released, which they say are going to be coming later this month. Now, do you have any idea what this is about, Greg?
I have no idea. Every time I hear, you know, is London ready? I think they're talking about the Olympics, which is this year. Will it be over by the time October rolls around?
Yeah,
is this
it'll
some
be
sort
over
of Olympic tie-in? Okay, so this is post Olympics. Mm-hmm. Does this have to do with first contact or the Vulcans coming? Do somehow Paramount knows in advance that There's a ship orbiting, waiting for the Olympics to be over so they can come down and mop up in the post hubbub.
Probably, you know, they were probably attracted to the London Olympics initially when a broadcast made its way through space and they saw that hideous thing called a logo.
Yeah, I don't know what that is.
I don't know what that is, and I'm shocked that they kept using it after all the uproar that surrounded it. But it's ugly enough that it really could have caught the attention of Vulcans or other extraterrestrials to come here and just find out what the hell's going on in London.
Nice. Well, I assume some sort of Star Trek convention or event, maybe something like... what was it called? Star Trek The Experience. Maybe a new Star Trek The Experience is opening in some posh section of London.
Could it be? What I think it is, though, I was listening to the Trekmate podcast recently, and I know they've been talking about trying to get some sort of event, some sort of convention in London. Mm-hmm. And so I suspect that this is what it's related to.
Okay.
That they're spearheading, organizing something, and there's going to be some kind of event coming up, but we'll see. They say later this month, we're at the beginning of March, so sometime in the next 3 to 4 weeks, maybe we'll actually find out what the details are. We'll have to go to StarTrekLondon.com and sign up so that we can be the first to know, along with everyone else who signed up.
Can they send me a text? Can they give me a call?
I think
they'll show up at my door and let me know.
Yeah, they'll send a courier.
Yeah. I'll sign up. I'll see which notification methods they allow me at StarTrekLondon.com. Now, something that came out of the blue that I had no idea was coming, but I'm very excited about, is these Bye Bye Robot Star Trek prints. Did you know Bye Bye Robot before this announcement?
No, I actually did not. Now, Bye Bye Robot is a company that was founded last year in 2011 mm-hmm. by Charity and Chris Wood. Now fans may know Charity and Chris because they run the fan site Subspace Communique, which has been around for quite a long time. So I did know about them and Subspace Communique before this, but somehow I actually did not know about the Bye Bye Robot itself.
Yeah, and they do some amazing artwork. You know, you can see on their, from before their Star Trek things, what looks to be like a Voyage Home homage, perhaps, with a couple... whales floating in space, but very cool space imagery coming out of them. And now they've gotten a license to do Star Trek things. And they started out with four paintings. Two of them are of the Prime 1701. One is of a Gorn, to make the Gorn captain very happy. And one which will make you very happy is a Trials of Tribbles. It's a triptych. Yeah, that's what it's called, a triptych, where it's actually three panels very, very humorously showing Tribbles getting all piled up, sort of like your the poster that you have behind you with the Tribbles growing and growing.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. And this one that they are doing, they have the yellow, blue, and red division colors, you know, from the original series there. The Gorn captain, I think, is going to be thrilled. He's just going to be scratching at his screen trying to place an order for this self-portrait, in fact, that...
He posed for it, I hear.
I understand.
He actually went to the Bye Bye Robot studios and posed in person.
That's what I was thinking, yeah. I hope he didn't eat Chris and Charity while he was there. You know, he sometimes has trouble controlling himself when he's around tasty humans.
Yes. Well, they have a very interesting art style where they actually paint on black. They say that all the black you see is not painted outlines. It's where they haven't painted. So So these have a very dark look, a very moody look, and very unique, something I've not seen from Star Trek artwork.
Yeah, to really appreciate them, you need to go to the site where you can really zoom in to really see the images. You know, we have the images on our site now, and I know a lot of the other Star Trek sites have the information and the images up as well, but... if you actually go to the site at byebyerobot.com, and that's, of course, B-Y-E as in bye-bye, you can see really, really close up so you can actually see the textures of the painting. And that's something that you need to go look at as opposed to just taking them like they're a flat poster, for example, because they are actually, you know, textured paintings.
Yeah, it's very, very impressive. The one downside is that they are, well, one, extremely limited. I believe there's runs of about 100 for each one.
Yeah, or maybe even less for some of them, I think.
Something like that. And they're quite expensive. Something like $300 or $500, depending on whether you get the small one or you get the big one. But I'm very close to actually purchasing one of these for my living room because it is really the finest Star Trek art I've seen in a long time.
I think you should get the Gornwin and put it right across from your bed. So it's just looking at you all the time.
Yeah, that would, interesting. The Tribbles one, the Tribble ones might be more apt.
Maybe so. So let me ask you about this. Right now, these are all from the original series, but they are officially licensed by CBS. And they are going to be doing other paintings in the future from the Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, and Enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
What do you want to see them paint? How about from the Next Generation? What would you want to see?
Well, I'm expecting the flute, perhaps Picard with the flute from The Inner Light, I think is a portrait everyone needs to see. I'm especially looking forward to Voyager. They're going to have a salamander triptych from a threshold.
That's going to be a big seller right there.
But pretty much any of the ships, I mean, even DS9 is going to look amazing on this wonderful background with the dark tones and the blues and the greens. Just to see all the ships, Voyager, the Enterprise D, DS9, the new Enterprise as well. Did it say, have they gotten the license to do from the movie, the new movie?
I believe it did say that, yeah. Both the original series and the Next Generation movies.
Well, so I'm wondering about the J.J. Abrams movie, if we're going to see an alternate Enterprise painting from them as well.
I don't know. The press release did not mention the J.J. Abrams, because remember, Paramount owns the rights to the J.J. Abrams movies.
Exactly.
I would assume Paramount also owns the rights to the original series and the Next Generation movies, although I don't know. It's kind of messy the way the whole who owns what in Star Trek is these days.
I guess we'll just have to hold on to see. What sort of painting are you most looking forward to, Chris?
You know, Voyager, it's hard for me to say. I think, you know that scene where Kes is kind of going crazy and she's eating the flowers? I think that would make a beautiful painting.
Nice. Very good.
From Deep Space Nine, it's very easy. I want a painting of Morn sitting at the bar.
Nice. That'd be perfect, actually.
Perfect, yeah. And then from the Next Generation, it's a toss-up. You know, I have two things in mind. The first one is Riker hitting on Lol. In 10 forward, I think it would be a great conversation piece, you know, if you had a party of people in your living room.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And of course, the other one would definitely be Geordi doing a barrel roll. I just can't get enough of Geordi doing those barrel rolls, you know.
Indeed.
It's like the quintessential Next Generation element.
Right. Well, maybe Larry can get us in touch with these people at Bye Bye Robot, and maybe we can make some of your dreams come true.
Maybe so. So if anyone wants to check those out, you can find the basic information on our website if you go to the Hyper Channel News Journal. And you can also go to byebyerobot.com and see what they've got going there. Okay, Greg, while we're talking about merchandise, now you got... a tea kettle, you've got a fracking toaster, you're just decking your kitchen all out. But I have a feeling that you don't have these next items yet.
Not yet, but I'm very excited. Basically, we have a Scotty and Uhura mug with the handle of the mug is the actual Starfleet insignia, which is pretty fantastic. And also salt and pepper shakers, which I believe are of the, it's the command insignia and then Kirk. And is Kirk the salt or is he the pepper? He seems like more of a pepper sort of guy.
Well, actually, I think here the Kirk one is actually a cookie jar. And
that actually makes even more sense.
It makes more sense, right? Yeah, especially as you move into the movies, right?
Right.
the insignia is the salt and pepper shaker. It's both.
I see. Oh, it's both
together. It splits
together.
Apart. Yeah.
I see. Now, does Picard make Riker manually dock them when you're all done?
I think so, yeah. It's when you get ready to season your food, He orders, you know, emergency. He wants you to do it quickly as well.
Right.
As quickly as possible, you have to separate the salt and pepper shakers.
Emergency salt and pepper shaker separation.
And
Lieutenant Worf, to the pepper shaker battle bridge.
And all the dinner guests.
Right outs only. No.
All the dinner guests give him the Warp 8 look. Like, what? We're going to separate the shakers?
Now hear this.
But then, yes, by printout only. But yes, then at the end, Riker does have to manually redock the shakers to get them back into the... And the strangest part of all this is that it's an insignia from the original series. And so we're not quite, I guess, you know, in the future, that's kind of considered like nostalgic television for them. You know,
right.
Watching the missions of Kirk and Spock and McCoy.
Yes, indeed. Actually, wasn't the original Enterprise able to do sausage separation? They just never did it on the show?
I think so, yeah. I think in the technical specs of the ship that the saucer could separate, but obviously for budgetary reasons, that just was not something that they could do.
Right. Well, perhaps we have someone who could have helped us separate the saucer, and that would have been James Doohan's Scotty that we want to remember today because it would have been his birthday March 3rd, I believe, as we're recording this.
Yes, that's right. Would have been March 3rd, and... How old was he? He was about 75 when he died. Is that right? 85?
Yeah.
He died in 2005, so.
Yeah, so he would have been 85 at that point.
Yeah. So he lived a nice long life as a Starfleet engineer. Do you have any favorite moments that you remember of Scotty or James Doohan?
Favorite memories. You know, probably just, you know, Star Trek II, where he's explained to Spock, you know, what has to be done to fix the ship, and Spock just says, I'm going to go in there. He says, no, you can't go in there. You know, it'll kill you. The radiation will kill you. You know, and all that. You know. And that's just, you know, heartbreaking moments.
Yeah, it was. It's
Scotty from the movies is who really, I really remember him, you know, the agony over his nephew dying. As silly as it is, he comes to the bridge. That's still a powerful moment in Star Trek II as well.
That's a good point. You know, it is Scotty from the movies that I think about most.
Yeah.
Scotty from the series, of course, he's there as an important part of the series. But when I think of Scotty, it's almost always Scotty from the movies.
Yeah, I feel like he's played more for comedy on the show, sort of the way Simon Pegg's Scotty is in the new movies. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the movies, Scotty became a much more serious character. I mean, still going for the comedy, but he wasn't there primarily for the comedy once the movies rolled around.
Yeah.
He became more of a rounded character, so to speak.
Yeah, for sure. Well, my favorite Scotty moments, boy, I don't know if there was a single moment. It's just, I've always liked Scotty because of the way that he could always find a solution to every situation. And I like the fact that he multiplies his repair estimates by a factor of four.
I think a lot of other engineers could have taken that lesson. They seem to give spot-on engineering estimates, and it gets them into trouble every time.
Well, that's Geordi. It's like Scotty tells Geordi in Relics, like, you didn't tell him how long it'll really take, did you?
Yes.
No. You can't do that.
Right.
So Geordi's like, well, of course I did. What else would I do? I told him I'll have it done 10 minutes early.
Right.
Yeah,
I mean, think what was the episode where he has to go into the holodeck and fall in love with an engineer in order to save the ship?
Oh, I guess Galaxy's... it's Booby Trap and Galaxy's Child. I think Booby Trap comes first, right?
Right.
And then Galaxy's Child is when she's actually really on the ship.
Right.
Is that right?
Right. I think it's Booby Trap I'm talking about. Yes.
So
Picard keeps calling. He's like, don't you have it fixed yet? Why isn't it fixed yet? And if Geordi had said at the outset, you know, this is going to take a good 20 hours to fix, then maybe Picard wouldn't have been on his case quite so much.
Maybe. Of course, you know, Scotty never went and hung out with women when the ship needed to be fixed either.
Don't. I hope you're not saying something bad about Jordy, Chris.
No, I'm just saying that Scotty, his first love was the ship and the engines.
That's very true.
And for Jordy, well, it was holographic women, apparently. Because Jordy could just never get a date, you know, as Dork Trek has explained in detail in the past.
He just went after the wrong girls, Chris. You know, he had a solution to his problem. He just never went there. Poor Jordy.
Absolutely. Well, before we move on to the next story, Greg, let's backtrack for a second and let everyone know where they can get those kitchen items, because is a Scotty kitchen item included in here, which is a kind of a mug, I guess. Although I have to say, from the shape of it, I'd be a little bit concerned about putting any hot liquids in it and having them fall over on me. But
yeah, they're a little oddly shaped. If you look at the pictures, which they are available in the Star Trek store, right? Or no, they're actually not.
I think they're in the StarTrek.com store. You can get them there.
StarTrek.com store. Check it out. Look at the pictures, because they are a bit odd for mugs. I think they're more of a display item, honestly.
Yeah, I was going to say. The handle's not quite. The handle's not quite functional, so I think they are a display item. But those are $14.99, and the shakers are $14.99, and the cookie jar is $49.99. So you're going to have to buy the cookie jar and then save up a little more and buy the cookies to put in it later, perhaps. But those are there, and you can get the mug to celebrate James Doohan's birthday as well.
Right. Very good.
Okay, so Greg, on the musical front, we have some news this week. Now, in the other side of the room, you were getting really excited because you were thinking that this was the expanded Star Trek IV soundtrack that was coming out. Although that did come out last year, and I'm pretty sure you bought two copies of it, didn't you?
I have several copies.
One to just cherish.
I have one of them framed. I carry one with me at all times. I have another one only to rip to my computer to play there. Star Trek 4. But this is Star Trek VI. That'd be Star Trek 6. The Undiscovered Country is getting the same sort of treatment that Star Trek 4 got, with pretty much every bit of music that was in the film. It will now be on the CD, which for the completists out there is quite excellent.
Well, it is nice that they're doing this. I'm glad, actually, because sometimes I'll go through and like there's a musical moment in the movies, even in the J.J. Abrams movie. Mm-hmm. There's a moment that I really like the music, and I go back to the soundtrack and I'm skimming through. I'm trying to find this, and it's not on there.
Yeah,
I don't know why they release such incomplete soundtracks to the movies in the first place, but they do. I guess it's so that all these years later they can come back and give us a two CD set. I don't know.
I think the idea is they're trying to make an album out of it. So they're trying to make musical pieces that are of about the same length, that have the emotional highs and lows from the film, but without being slavish to the film, because they figure you're not watching the film along with it. You don't want the music just to, you know, fade out at a weird moment, or just a little piece of, like, you know, 20 seconds here or there. But yeah, we do want that. That's exactly what we want. If we buy the music from the movie, we want all the music.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, this one is coming out. Now, the Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country score was composed by Cliff Eidelman, and it's one of my favorite soundtracks as well. It has that kind of, it captures the essence of that movie really well. It has that kind of dark, foreboding feeling to it. It's a really beautiful score. And it's quite a contrast to 5, which came before, which I know everyone makes fun of Star Trek 5, and I think we've done that as well for various things. But Star Trek 5 had a beautiful soundtrack. It was very Copeland-esque. Mm-hmm. And then this one is very different from that. And this is going to have, the first disc has 22 tracks, and that were on the original, I believe. And then there are 4 more tracks on here. And then the second one has 13 tracks. Actually, the second disc is the original release, which I have, which was put out by MCA, if I remember correctly.
They're trying to give you the best of both worlds, where you can get both all the music that was in the film, plus a few extras, and then you can also get the more structured, designed album experience that they released back in 91.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So this one is coming from Entrada, and it's going to be $24.99. and they are accepting pre-orders right now if you go over to their website. So I'll have to go check that out, but I am right. looking forward to this, and we'll probably pick it up because it is one of my favorite soundtracks from the films.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind. I mean, I'm mostly looking forward to just another Michael Giacchino soundtrack, which hopefully should be coming out next year. That's what I'm mostly looking forward to. But this Star Trek VI, I do remember. I remember we spoke before. I don't remember the music at all from Star Trek IV. I do remember the Star Trek VI music as being very excellent.
Definitely, you remember Star Trek IV? Even, I think they had a track on there done by the Yellow Jackets. It's all, you know, like a goodness. Jazz and, yeah. Yeah, you claim you don't remember IV, but I know that you've got it set as your ringtone, in fact.
Oh, here we go. Star Trek Nemesis, music from the original motion picture soundtrack, only $9.99. For, just so you can relive all of those memories of Star Trek Nemesis, Chris.
All right. Now, are you waiting for the Entrada special 3-CD set of Nemesis with the special recorded audio commentary by Stuart Baird?
Yeah, I'm sure that's coming never.
It'll come out the same time that the Enterprise Companion book comes out.
Right.
All right. Well, moving on to the next item here, Greg, we have a little bit of Star Trek Online news, which we haven't talked about on here, I think, in several weeks since the free-to-play went on, maybe. But
yeah, and actually, I hear people have been playing it. The guys at Dork Trek have been getting into it. Have you played? Have you played with the USS Bonner?
Yes, the Bonner, because apparently, and I think this is funny, they said that they couldn't put boner into the system. It rejected it as a dirty word. So it's, there are the USS Bonner, the crew of the USS Bonner.
But yeah, Chris, have you been playing, have you had a chance even to jump back into STO?
No, I unfortunately have not. I would love to, and as I've always said on here, if they had it available for OS X, I could take a few minutes and just jump in quickly, but when I have to go through the whole shutting down my whole workstation and rebooting into Windows just to get into the game, I have to actually be able to set aside some serious time to do it. And just with recent scheduling, I haven't been able to, but I at some point definitely am planning to, because my ship, I do have a ship that I used to go into the game with, and it's sitting there at space dock, and if I don't go get it soon, I think Kirk is going to try to steal it, probably. And
well, that would be because your ship is named the USS Zoe Saldana.
That's true. And I think that's something that we might talk a little bit more about just a little bit later when we get to movie
A little later
news.
In the show. So they are doing more of their multi-episode arcs in STO, including, well, this one is now called the 2800, which I'm wondering is a reference to the 4400. Which is the show that I'm sure many of our listeners are familiar with.
Yeah, that was my first thought. Of course, the 4400 was Ira Stephen Baer's show that he did for, I believe it was USA. Is that what it was on in the States?
USA Network, yes.
Like a summer show. It has some similarities, in fact. Now, I don't know that it's just coincidence, but the idea here is that a lost fleet returns intent on completing its mission. Now, of course, we've seen this in Star Trek before, you know, where you have Klingons who come back who don't know the war is over, for example, right? But in this case, they come back, Deep Space Nine is threatened, and it's up to you as the player to thwart the Dominion and save the station. And they released the first episode on February 11th, so it's been going on a little while, but just this weekend, as we record the show here, the next to last episode has been released, and this one is called Facility 4028. And StarTrek.com has intercepted some communications between, I guess, a scientist at the facility and a researcher, something. And they've been running this on their site as kind of a tie-in promotion to this episode being released. It's Franklin Drake and Philia Fair of Starfleet Medical, and these are memos.
Very cool.
So there's a spy in there somewhere, I guess.
Again, I feel like we need somebody who's actually in the game to come report to us on what's actually going on, because it's all a little odd to me just reading about it. I'm hoping I can get a chance to jump in. Well, now I'm running mountain lion on this Mac. I don't even know if I can do boot camp and put Windows on it until I'm on a off of the developer release. I don't know. It's really frustrating. This just isn't for Macs, because I feel like if you're trying to grasp for people to come join the game, why would you go free to play before at least trying to put it on Mac first? You know, maybe that was the only kick they needed.
Especially these days, you know, in years past, going Windows only, I can understand because, you know, all games. But these days, especially amongst home users, so many people use Mac now that you really need to make these games cross-platform. That's what I liked about what Infinite Space was doing, that they were making it browser-based. Now, I don't know, StarTrek.com, Star Trek Online is so intense on the hardware, especially the video hardware. I don't know that it could run in a browser, but I mean, certainly Macs have sufficient video power to do the same things, so they should be able to do it. And I hope that in the coming year, maybe they will.
Until then, we can just watch from the outside these really interesting sounding episodes. Hopefully, we'll be able to play through those again when we do finally join the game.
Yeah, absolutely. So this one's out. The final one comes out on March 10th. It's called Boldly They Rode, and that'll wrap up the 2800 series of feature episodes. There are not 2800 episodes in the series. It's just the name. So don't be scared off by the sheer volume of missions that you must complete. I think there are five, maybe six episodes in the series.
That makes sense.
So, yeah. But definitely, we do need to get someone on here who's like a diehard Star Trek Online player.
Yeah, definitely.
And really talk about Star Trek Online a bit more. Okay, Greg, well, moving along, one thing I wanted to throw out is the new episode of Matter Stream, which will be out by the time this Ready Room comes out. And I had a really interesting discussion at the end of last week with John Tenuto, which many people will know because he writes for Star Trek Magazine. He writes over at TrekMovie.com as well. And he's a sociology professor at the College of Lake County in Grays Lake, Illinois. And for the past 4 years, he's been researching, along with his wife, Maria Jose, the papers at the University of Iowa. They have the Nicholas Myers papers, because Meyer was an alumnus of Iowa.
Right.
And he also recently got permission from CBS to go into the Gene Roddenberry archives at UCLA. And he's been researching the life of Ricardo Montalban, as well as the making of The Wrath of Khan and The Undiscovered Country and Nicholas Meyer. And he's going to be doing three events coming up this month in March. And two of them are there in Illinois, and one of them is at the St. Louis Science Center. Because we've talked on here before about Star Trek the Exhibition, and it's back at the St. Louis Science Center right now. And they're having a fan day coming up at the end of the month. But just if you want all the details, go over to our site, go to trek.fm/ms. That will get you to Matter Stream. And again, by the time this Ready Room's out, you'll find the new episode on there. And we talk for, you know, a good half hour, 40 minutes. Very interesting, mostly about Ricardo Montalban. A bit about Khan. I did get John's thoughts on the possibility of Khan appearing in the next J.J. Abrams film, and, you know, how he feels about that, and because of how Khan as a character was intertwined with Ricardo Montalban's life experience as well. So it's very
interesting, actually. Yeah, I'm very much looking forward to listening to this Matter Stream now. I didn't realize there was that much from Montalban's life to really get into. So now I'm quite excited to hear.
Yes, it is. There's really a lot of stuff, and it's very interesting. So I'll quickly give you the dates of the events, and then you can get all the rest from Matter Stream. There's the Life and Legacy of Ricardo Montalban. That's going to take place at the College of Lake County on Tuesday, March 20th. And that's from 11 a.m. to 12:15. And it's free. You can actually contact John for more information. He's on Twitter at JTenuto. And then if you go over to the show notes here, we'll have the information as well. That's actually the second event. The first one is at Grays Lake Public Library. That's rare photos in the making of Star Trek 2 and 6. And they've got about 100 to 140, I believe it is, photos that have really never been seen before that they found from the archives. some very interesting things there with like Nicholas Meyer and Ricardo Montalban and so forth.
Do they have one of Ricardo Montalban putting on the fake plastic chest?
I haven't seen that one yet, but it might be in there. And if you're lucky, John may be handing out prosthetic conchests at the door so that the whole audience can wear those during the presentation. I certainly hope so. I mean, that's...
Well, that's
if
what
you want to get more people to come out, I mean, I would promote that for sure.
Definitely. Yeah, I mean, you didn't mention that one of the things spurring this is that this year is the 45th anniversary of Space Seed and the 30th anniversary of Wrath of Khan. So a very good time to celebrate the life of Khan and the man who brought Khan to life.
Yeah, it's amazing it's been that long since those came out. So the Rare Photos thing is going to be on March 10th, 2 to 5:30. It's also free. You do need to go to the library website and register just so they know how many people are going to be coming. So we'll put a link to that there. And then, as I mentioned, St. Louis Science Center, Star Trek Fan Day, that's March 24th. Kind of an all-day event. John will be presenting at 11 a.m., the Rare Photos. And at 2 p.m., it's another session called A Celebration of Fans, the History of the Official Star Trek Fan Club. And that's also, we talk a little bit about that one in the Matter stream as well. So we'll have links to all these on the show notes page here for the Ready Room. And again, trek.fm/ms will get you to Matter stream, or you can find it in iTunes or Stitcher and catch that episode. Everybody knew their part, from a fanny to a slip, and a kicking from the hip. Everybody was kung fu fighting. Huh. Those cats were fast as lightning. In fact, it was a little bit frightening. Huh. But they fought with expert timing. There was Punky Billy Jean. All right, wow. Greg. Well, more photos are pouring out from the set of Star Trek 2013 as we move into movie news and rumors here. And I heard this anyway, that when these pictures first came out, that Zachary Quinto was saying that what we were seeing was not a fight scene. Apparently, they were not kung fu fighting.
Right. Somehow that the punches and the Vulcan death grips and all this was not a fight. I don't know. I don't know what Quinto's definition of a fight scene is. But now that the video's come out, I think it's pretty clear what's going on.
Yeah, I would say so. The if you haven't seen this, if you're listening and you've seen the photos and you haven't seen the video, I think you can see it over at trekmovie.com, or if you go to YouTube, you'll find it there if you like search for Star Trek 2 video or something. But it's actually a video someone shot, I guess, with a cell phone, probably, of the same sequence that we've been seeing in these photos. And they've got the fight scene choreographer showing them how to do the punches, and then they're practicing the punches. And
right.
It's and actually, definitely I heard, a fight scene.
That choreographer, was that the same guy that Chris Pine has go with him everywhere he goes just in case he wants to punch somebody?
Yeah, that's right. They after he punched Simon Pegg, apparently, they had to assign a stuntman and a choreographer to go around with him because they said, we can't have any more black eyes. You know, we've already got this photo out of Pegg with what looks like a black eye. We've had to rewrite the script. Thank goodness there's no writer's strike right now. We've had to rewrite the script to explain why Scotty has a black eye for the rest of the movie. And we just can't have any more of this. I mean, we don't need Zoe having a black eye. You know, we don't need...
That'd be impossible to explain.
Yeah. I mean, we don't want to go there with the Spock-Uhura relationship. We don't want to get into the dark, you know, kind of...
Yeah.
You know, we don't want to do that. So we just got to make sure that there's someone else that's not on camera that Chris Pine can punch if he feels the need.
Now, but actually, I was going to say, skipping forward, we can go back, but skipping forward a little bit in our lineup here... I think someone might be wanting to punch Chris Pine after some of these pictures came out. I see Chris Pine hounding in on Spock's girlfriend here. I see Uhura very uncomfortable in a golf cart with Chris Pine. I don't know how this is going to go over with Spock.
Yeah, I know. She does look uncomfortable in those photos, doesn't she? And I was thinking, it's like, wow, when he's not hitting somebody, he's hitting on somebody, apparently, on the set. And I think she's saying to him, she's like, look, Chris, I think you're just taking this whole I'm Kirk thing. I'm the new Shatner thing a little bit too far. You know, look, you don't have to hit on all the girls on the set of the movie. It's just not cool, man.
Right. And then Chris Pine said, I'm Captain Kirk.
Oh, but yeah, these photos are, boy, I don't know. There's the one of Zachary Quinto there who, what's he just walking around? Looks kind of like Spock is trying to get the, like a maybe Star Trek VI Kirk look going there or something.
Yeah, something like that. I don't know. He kind of looks like he's wandering around modern day Los Angeles. Maybe he's looking for nuclear vessels.
Maybe. I wonder if he just roams around Los Angeles with those pointed ears on all the time now.
Well, it's him and Daniel Day-Lewis from Abraham Lincoln just sort of, you know, hang out in coffee shops, staying in character.
Hey, did you see the photo of Spock? There are two Spocks in the photo. Did you see this one?
Ah, yes.
I'm wondering, maybe the next movie, it's like The Enemy Within, but it's Spock that's been split instead of Kirk. So now there are two Spocks.
It won't be quite as good when it's just, I, in fact, am Spock. It doesn't quite have the impact of the, I'm Captain Kirk.
Right. I am Spock. It's only logical that you are also Spock because you have the same hair that I have.
It is interesting that we both appear to be Spock at the same time.
Oh, so obviously that must be his fight scene double. So
right.
I don't know. Maybe they throw him off that barge or something, and then that's the guy that goes in. So, all right. Well, one thing I will say about all these photos that are coming out is that basically they're just showing people sitting around on a movie set. Yes. And the articles even say things like, the photos don't reveal anything. It's like, so we're just hungry for any photos of anybody.
Exactly.
I'm expecting soon we're going to have like new photos from the set. It's going to be like the food service people putting food onto the cart. And it's going to be, these photos don't even show any of the actors in the film. However, they were taken on the set of the next movie.
Right. Here's a Coke can that was drunk by Chris Pine not 10 minutes ago. Yeah, you're stretching it a bit there, guys. Stretching it a bit there.
Oh, but some other news from the movie. Now, Cumberbatch appreciates praise, which I would assume that if you were an actor and you were praised, that you would appreciate that.
Right. No, it is great. I mean, one thing he points out is how, I believe it was Chris Pine was going on about how he's a classically trained actor. And Cumberbatch says, you know, he only did 1 year at drama school. So he's not really that classically trained, but he does appreciate everybody saying how trained and wonderful he is.
Well, the problem is, I guess that Chris Pine must have just finished shooting a film with Jeff Goldblum. And so he is extra impressed with the bit of classical training that Cumberbatch had. So.
Indeed. That makes perfect sense. But yeah, I mean, Cumberbatch doesn't have much here in the way of plot details, but he does sound very excited to be on the set, very excited to be shooting Star Trek. Obviously, he's not going to mention the fist fights he gets into with Chris Pine, but everything he says about the film sounds quite positive.
Yeah. Well, while we're talking about Cumberbatch, let's get into our favorite little game here of speculating who he's playing again for a minute.
Okay.
Because we've had another week to kind of think about the photos, think about what we're seeing, and hear what other fans are saying. Now, I'm still hearing a lot of people who think that he's playing Khan. And
I can't, man, that really needs to stop.
But they do have a valid point. That everyone is pointing out the fact that in what we're seeing, whoever this is that Spock is fighting is holding his own against Spock. And in some cases, he's actually fighting back against Spock. Now, Vulcans are supposed to be so much stronger. We saw in the first movie, when Spock and Kirk fought, that Kirk was completely unable to stand up to Spock's strength. So whoever Cumberbatch is playing apparently has super strength. Mm-hmm. And that would be Khan, or could be someone else from Khan's group of genetically enhanced people.
True, true. He could be an augment of some sort. I cannot see that happening at this stage. Although the more they show he appears human, the more likely that does seem. I think more likely than Khan, honestly, given the how angry the fan base would be more someone like Trelane, which I keep lobbying for Trelane to be in this film. But I feel more like JJ's going for the more hard sci-fi and it's sort of pushing away the sort of fantasy element from the original series and even Next Gen that I love and a lot of the fans love, but I don't know if even that will be showing up in the film.
Yeah, I don't think it's Trelane, not from these photos, because Trelane would be using some kind of magic trick to fight back.
Probably. And I mean, he could have lost his powers. There's lots of things. But yeah, I don't know what would explain the being impervious to the neck pinch. I did postulate last week the Tordarian theory, which has not gone over well among the fan base, but I'm still sticking by that one. I think he could maybe he's part Tordarian. You know, right. Maybe he's got a little bit of Tordarian on his mother's side.
Maybe like he's like a quarter or maybe an eighth.
Right.
It's just enough that the Vulcan death grip, again as MTV calls it, doesn't work on him. Yeah, it could be.
Don't know. Yeah, endless speculation. We'll see. When do you think we'll actually know? When will a press release be coming out?
Well, I don't think a press release will be coming out. I think a copy of the script will be coming out, though. I know J.J. Abrams is not going to personally announce who this character is. I'm pretty confident of that. Now, the studio, they might put out a press release, and then J.J. will see it and go, crap,
right.
What are you guys doing? But I doubt that as well. I think we're just going to get a leaked copy of the script. Or we're going to get a photo that someone snaps that clearly indicates, you know, what the storyline is. There's like some element in it that we can clearly connect to the original series and say, ah, yeah. Or maybe in the comics, there's going to be a hint dropped in there finally at some point who it is.
Yeah, that's very possible.
Speaking of the comics, now we can say, like last week I speculated, maybe it could be George Kirk, but I think now I can let that go.
Right.
That's not going to be it.
I mean, don't take this as spoilers for the comic if you haven't read the comic, but regardless of how it ends, no, I don't think that it's looking like George Kirk will be showing up in the film.
Yeah, I don't think so either. So it's
not I was thinking back to 2008 that this is about the time we were getting our first teaser trailer for the film, but that's also because the film was coming out in December of 2008 at that point. And so at this point, it's still a little... Actually, I guess we're a couple of months past when we got that teaser trailer. So we're probably still a good 4 or 5 months out from even a teaser trailer being in theaters.
Yeah, I think so. And when it does come out, it's just going to be these people refitting the Enterprise. You know, the welders on the Enterprise refitting it and repairing damage from the last movie.
That's
pretty much all it's going to be.
Pretty much, you know, repairing Spock's eyebrows, you know, fixing Kirk's punching hand, all of those things.
Putting makeup on Simon Pegg's eye.
Bum, 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 bum. It's going to be fantastic.
Yeah, they'll probably use some stock footage from the last movie of the Enterprise flying through warp or something like that.
Right.
Actually, they probably will.
Yeah, no, I'm pretty sure we've said exactly what the teaser trailer is going to look like.
Exactly. But, remember this
we'll see.
When it comes out.
Exactly. But again,
going to have Greg singing the theme music.
I should do that. I should do my own homebrew trailer.
Oh, you could. You could use your plush Enterprise and...
I should just try to recreate the entire first trailer for the original film, or the 2009 film. Because it's really just images of welders on the ship. I'm sure I could manage that.
So I'm going to get a message from you this week, and you're going to say, okay, I was just down at Target, and I picked up a welder's helmet, right?
Exactly. Now, of course, it's not JJ that puts together the trailers itself. It's actually the production company, or actually the studio, Paramount. And it is interesting to see that Paramount and Bad Robot together have extended their deal.
Yeah.
I don't know how... how long, but well, okay, through 2015. So I think we know that the Star Trek films would continue to be coming out of Paramount, but this pretty much guarantees that JJ's production company will continue to be making the films and other films coming out of Bad Robot. I mean, we've had Cloverfield, we had Super 8, and I believe there's been some other ones not directed by JJ. Mission Impossible 4 was also Bad Robot. So this this deal that's creating some actually pretty good movies is going to be staying together. It's probably my favorite collaboration other than Disney Pixar that's going on right now.
Yeah. Yeah, I think Mission Impossible 3 was also Paramount Bad Robot. So they
I
have
think
had,
you're probably right.
Yeah, quite a lot going on. Am I correct that they signed a 3-picture deal for the Star Trek movies? They signed the actors to a 3-picture deal, right?
Right. That's my understanding. But I don't know what that has. I don't know what relation that has to this deal in particular. But yeah, I know that there were 3 movies that the actors were signed on for.
Yeah. Because I'm thinking now, if we're getting this movie in 2013, was it May 2013? The next movie, the third movie, would be beyond the end of this extension, because this extension is to December 2015, and I don't think we would see a new movie till 2016.
Well, I don't know. I would expect that part of this deal is them telling JJ and, you know, Damon and Burke and all of them, you've got to have the third film in 2015. My thought,
think?
I do. I think that this deal really says that the 2009 to 2013 is way too long. They need to get back on an every 2-year release schedule. And I think Paramount's really pushing them to do that.
Yeah, but this would be less. This would be like 1.5 years later. They would have to take like 6 months off and go right into production. They'd have to be writing the script for the third movie as they're wrapping post for this one.
Well, you'd have summer 2013. You could do summer 2015. That's pretty much what they used to do. If you think back to,
That's true.
The next gen film,
2015. Yeah, that would be. Yeah, that could. Yeah, maybe. Yeah, maybe so. So
I mean,
maybe
the
it would come at the
2 years.
End of this extension deal.
Right. And then at that point they'll probably start talking about, okay, do we want to do another 3 films with JJ, or do we want to try something new?
Yeah. So hopefully they will get back on that schedule because, yes, 2009 to 2013 is definitely too long. You can't keep momentum going with such a long break like that.
Yeah. I mean, that's basically the break they had between Insurrection and Nemesis, and I think we all know what happened there.
Yeah. You need to keep people wanting more, but not so long that the momentum is gone. And then when you bring the next one out, it's like you're starting it up again from scratch, which is almost what's happening right now. And maybe that's why we're getting so many leaked photos to create buzz about.
Right. Remember Star Trek came out 3 years ago and you were really excited about Star Trek again. And then you forgot about it. But remember, it's awesome. It really is. Your girlfriend wanted to see it. Remember? She did. Really.
So play the date card.
They will be playing the date card, trust me. We're gonna see a lot more Zoe Saldana in the marketing for this one. She's got a gun now, and she's all over like the tabloids. She's becoming like a thing, so they're gonna be using her in every single trailer and every single poster.
And not only the trailers but the title, Star Trek Zoe's Got a Gun. So every school child knows that Zefram Cochran made first contact with the Vulcans in Montana on April 5th, 2063. In fact, a lot of these kids have been there on a field trip. There's a statue. And today we're going to talk about a story that kind of rewrites these events a little bit, because like a lot of things in our history, what's recorded in books may not be what really happened. And the episode we'll talk about is Enterprise's Carbon Creek. And of course, I have Greg with me and with us again this week. It's been a while. Friend of the show, Michael Fisher. Welcome back, Michael.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. It's good to be back. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you back.
Yeah, our pleasure. Good to have you back. All right. So Carbon Creek, guys. This is an episode which I personally like quite a lot, and I'm going to be really interested to hear what you think about it, because as is the case with a lot of Enterprise, I think it can be a little bit polarizing to fans. You know, there's some elements in it that maybe people think violate canon, and then there's some other stuff in there that's really great Star Trek. So yeah. Michael, as our joining us again today, tell us right off the bat, what are your initial thoughts on Carbon Creek?
I remember watching Carbon Creek. I saw Carbon Creek for the first time a number of years ago. I think this was one of the ones that slipped by me on my initial viewing. Huh. And I remember being confronted with it and in the first 5 minutes saying, oh, it's going to be one of these Star Trek episodes. Like, yes, I will tell you the story over dinner. And it was my great-grandmother, but it's going to be me because I'm the actress who's going to play this part. And it's, you know, mm-hmm. But I was really captivated with it on the first time around. And then this time with the rewatch, which I just did a couple hours ago, I still liked it quite a bit. But it is an episode which, to me, highlights some of Enterprise's real kind of glaring deficiencies. And the number one of those just being, in a broad sense, just pacing. I mean, this script was probably 25 pages long. And, you know, generally the kind of unspoken rule is a minute a page. And this is what Enterprise does. Like, they just, God, the pacing and all these. I mean, I'm so interested in it, but it's like you're feeding me bits of awesome through an eyedropper.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, I want, you know, I don't, you know. So pacing was a real problem for me. But I really do like this episode. I think it's cute. And as my roommate said, the kitsch factor is just amped way up on this one. So it's a very cute episode.
So Mike Fisher says it's cute. I think it's very interesting. I especially like how it comes right after the two-parter. It comes right after Shockwave. And it is, as you say, sort of a, oh, let's tell a story around the dinner table. But I like that sort of breather, you know, after such an intense time. I think, didn't they do the same thing after Best of Both Worlds? They did Home or Family.
Family?
It was Family. And then Enterprise does Home after the...
Enterprise does Home.
Right. I love it when they do this. Right. Just, you know, step back from the intensity and just do something a little bit easier. And this also shows off that great threesome of Archer and Trip and T'Pol. And it is, it's sort of the Kirk, McCoy, Spock from the original series, but it's Enterprise. And I don't think everybody...
I'm sure Michael agrees with you there, but...
I don't think everybody likes it, and we can get into that, but I really like it. I think it works really well, especially in the first couple seasons of the show, especially before the whole flirtation starts between Trip and T'Pol. I like these dinner scenes, and I think it's so cute that they make her tell them a story. And the whole episode is just her telling a story. It's like Princess Bride, where it keeps cutting back and they're, like, you know, joshing her about it. So I think it's a really great, different kind of Enterprise episode.
Yeah. I like Trip in the scenes at the dinner table. It's just classic Trip.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
How old are you anyway?
Like, wait, what? You're telling me, you're trying to sell me this story? Yeah. It's great.
Classic Trip. Well, you know, I hear what you're both saying. I like this episode. I think that it's an episode that can be polarizing because if you watch it, there are a lot of elements in there where you feel like, okay, well, the writers are just, they're mining things from the past. There are, you know, scenes like from The City on the Edge of Forever. You've got, they steal some clothes, you know, to disguise that they're Vulcans. Mm-hmm. Mestral wears a hat.
Right off a clothesline.
They go
too,
you have Maggie who's running a bar, and then T'Pol gets a job at the bar, and you know, versus Edith, who's running a soup kitchen, mm-hmm. and Kirk gets like handyman jobs from her.
Yeah, well, Mistral plays pool just like Tuvok. You know, they both even say the same thing about how it's just a game of geometry.
Yeah.
And that's a direct homage to Data playing poker for his initial bit of money in Time's Arrow.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. This is definitely Star Trek mining itself. I agree.
There is a lot of that. And so it can pull you out of the story because in a way it does feel like the story feels like a rehash of past Star Treks. But if you can get beyond that and you actually listen to what's going on in the story, it's a deeper story than those past stories were because of what they get into discussing and what they're arguing here. But we'll talk about that a little bit more later, because the first thing I really wanted to focus on, though, was the very, very surface element of what this does in terms of fans who are really into canon, is that it kind of rewrites the whole events in for the movie First Contact, you know, and how humans and how Vulcans first met. It doesn't bother me because I can perfectly understand the fact that maybe that history isn't quite what people think it is,
right,
you know, in the 24th century. But what about you guys?
I mean, I never bought that Montana 2061 was the first time aliens ever landed on Earth. I mean, we already know from, what was it, Little Green Men, that they were Ferengi on Earth in the 40s.
that's right.
We know that the whole Enterprise just comes in the 60s to stop whatever that was.
Like Gary 7 there.
What was Assignment Earth? So all of that happens.
Yeah, Gary 7. Yeah.
And so, you know, there were aliens on Earth then. Plenty of the times that aliens have been on Earth prior to 2061, it's still... I want to hear what Mike has to say, but it's still the time that official contact happened, and that I think what the most important thing that happened in 2061 was Vulcan officially recognizing humanity and Earth as a part of the galaxy, a part of the conversation, if you will, you know, saying bringing them into the club, and that this episode doesn't change that.
Yeah, I agree, Greg. I think. I mean, if I'm understanding the counter argument correctly, it's that Vulcans would not have come to Earth this early because they were not interested enough until they detected warp travel.
Right.
Is that what the naysayers are pissed about? Yeah.
Well, that's what the story is in First Contact. It was warp travel that
is what got their attention.
Made them say we have to actually make formal contact now.
Right. I mean, they need to update the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy from saying, you know, harmless to harmless,
right.
And now they have warp.
They're no longer an inert component.
Right.
Yeah, they're sort of a player.
Which
yeah.
is now mostly harmless.
Right.
Right. Now, you know, I mean, if you're going to watch Enterprise, you have to be, you absolutely have to be ready to give it the space it needs to do its thing. I mean, Enterprise had enough trouble. Enterprise did throw the rule book out to a degree. And they still found themselves in trouble and not being able to tell compelling stories for the better part of 2 years, even with that advantage. So if you're going to watch Enterprise, and you certainly it's fun to bitch a little bit as a fan, but it's really, you know, no, I have no problem with this at all.
Well, Greg, you talk about the timeline. Now, as far as canon is concerned, the first face-to-face contact that I can think of is with the Ferengi, when Quark and Nog and Rom and Odo, although the humans never actually see Odo,
right,
but he's there with them. When that happens in Little Green Men, that was in 1947.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Carbon Creek, these events take place in 1957. And then, like you said, in Tomorrow is Yesterday, they go back in the 60s.
Oh, there's that
Assignment,
one too, yeah.
There's that one. There's Assignment Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Those happen after Carbon Creek.
Very true. Okay.
But then there's even more. Now, I don't know if you guys have ever read this novel, but there was a novel called Strangers from the Sky. Hmm. And this was written in 87 by Margaret Wanderer Bonanno. And it's a really interesting book. It kind of predates when Star Trek books became really huge in the 90s, where you had like titles coming out constantly.
Oh, yeah.
This was back in the days of like Prime Directive, and it's even earlier than Federation, these kind of big famous Star Trek books. But Strangers from the Sky is a story of First Contact and the Vulcans crash in the South Pacific.
Oh, wow.
And that's how humans and Vulcans met. And then in 90, was it six, First Contact came along and had the whole thing about Montana.
Right.
So that was rewriting something that, you know, fans had kind of known from this book. And now you have the story in Carbon Creek. So, but anyway you look at it, it's really the Ferengi that are the actual first face-to-face where humans know that these are aliens here. You have things like Time's Arrow where they go back to the 1800s, but they don't really, I mean, Mark Twain is the only person who knows that there are aliens there at that point.
The Ophidian-toting aliens, yeah.
And in The City on the Edge of Forever, Edith Keeler never knows that Spock is an alien.
Right.
So there's no first contact going on there, acknowledged.
Yeah, and there is an interesting question of what did happen when, was it Mistral, their friend?
Yeah.
What did happen when he dies? Like, I'm assuming, I guess you could tell his wife, you know, have me cremated immediately, but he must tell at least her that he's, you know, different. It's hard to...
Unless he never
He got his ears caught in a mechanical rice-picking device. Yeah.
Right. And
my friend is obviously Chinese.
And he has green blood, Michael. How do you explain the green blood?
Radioactive. He worked in a watch factory. Yeah, he has radium in his blood.
Radium.
Yes, that's the problem.
That makes perfect sense.
I was just going to say,
you didn't know that?
His mother made him eat too much spinach and broccoli and other green vegetables.
Oh, that's
his
even
child
better.
Pollute his blood.
He is a very interesting. I don't know if you want to hop right into this, but he is a very interesting Vulcan. We see him right off the bat pick up a pretzel and with his hands. This is something Vulcans don't do. They don't touch food with their hands. But he just dives right in, grabs a pretzel out of that bowl, starts munching on it. T'Pol isn't, you know. It isn't like these are, they're early Vulcans and they don't have so many hang-ups. He's the most different Vulcan we've ever seen.
I don't know. I think T'Pol is an especially stuck-up Vulcan.
Oh, she is super conservative, isn't she? Like,
I think so.
Super T'Pol, you mean? Do you mean T'Pol or do you mean T'Pol's second foremother or whatever?
Well, both. I mean, what's interesting is that T'Mir is, you can see T'Pol's mother must be just like her because T'Mir is just like T'Pol.
Oh, yeah.
Well, actually, didn't
even more so.
We met T'Pol's mother at some point, didn't we? And it turns out she's kind of a rebel. She's not well liked in Vulcan society. So maybe it's
that's what happens.
Right,
it's you rebel. It's every other generation skips a generation.
Exactly. Yeah. So T'Pol is just like her second foremother. But she is. Yeah. She's super stodgy. She must come from the Orthodox sect on Vulcan because she's so against everything.
I see. She's Vulcan Orthodox.
Right.
So when she's in the bar and she's going to meditate in front of that candle and Jack asks her, what are you doing? She should have said, well, I'm a Vulcan Orthodox.
Right. Required to do this. We do get to talk about Vulcans being vegetarians, though. When they're starving, the surviving Vulcans are starving in the woods and they see the deer and there's, are you suggesting we eat it? And, it brought to my mind the question that I haven't thought in a while, and I don't know if you guys have or if we've discussed it. When the hell did the Vulcans become vegetarians? Was that in Broken Bow when we established that? Because it wasn't established in the original series, right? Or am I completely wrong on that? Is that an Enterprise thing?
Well, we never saw Spock munching on, hot wings or something. That's for sure. But
Slim Jims. No Slim Jims in Spock's quarters.
Speaking of which, I'm going to get some hot wings.
Yum and Rand brings him some Slim Jims.
Then next gen, we didn't really see any Vulcans. What about, I'm thinking Tuvok. I'm thinking Tuvok must have said at some point that he's a vegetarian.
That could well be.
Yeah. I really don't know for sure, but
I feel like such a lax right now.
Voyager being the next series after the original series that actually had a Vulcan as a main character. Yeah. And they did with Tuvok delve a lot into Vulcan beliefs.
Yeah. And stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
Yeah, I feel like Voyager really fleshed out Vulcans that got them to a place where they could do a character like T'Pol, where she does feel like a fully rounded Vulcan character. You really go back and look at Spock and I don't know about you, but Spock doesn't strike me as Vulcan. He just strikes me as Spock. You don't feel
he's
that
just alien.
Yeah. You don't feel that weight of a particular alien culture behind him. You just feel like
not
he's...
in the series.
Exactly. Not
in the
series.
Later movies, like in Star Trek VI, you really feel that there's this culture behind him.
That's true.
More so than the series.
But I love getting into the meditating and the holding back of emotion. And I guess what
Kowtow as well.
Right. Yeah. That's very interesting. And finally, they get into the Kirshara, I believe is the correct term, where we learn, mm-hmm. you know, why the Vulcans sort of became the way they are later on. But here we see differing viewpoints inside of Vulcan society. We have Tamir, who, as we said, is this very stodgy, conservative Vulcan. We have... Now I'm forgetting his name. What is the name of the one who's going out on dates?
Strawn.
Mestral
is the one. Mestral is the one right. That's dating Maggie. Yeah.
Right. So Mestral is very, very curious about everything and just wants to learn everything he can and doesn't have this sort of, we have to step back. He apparently doesn't believe in the Vulcan Prime Directive, which we can talk about. And then there's the other one, the plumber, who...
That's fine.
Who Mo. Just sort of wants
Mo.
To...
Let's call him Mo.
Right, Mo. I love him. I think he's just there to provide... a contrast to both of them, because he just doesn't care about any of this. He just wants to go home.
Right.
They needed someone to sit in the background and try to build some kind of communication.
Right.
Yeah. And to finish this like domestic 50s Vulcan
exactly.
home, which is hilarious yes. to see.
Right. I mean, if it just been the two of them, it wouldn't have been quite as hilarious. When you've got three no. in that little house, I don't know what people must have thought right. of them.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think Tamir would have been happy just staying on Earth. She just would have stayed away from everyone and not become part of it. But this other guy, he just wants to get off the planet. Like, he doesn't know why he's here. These people are backwards. They don't have warp drive. They can't fix their sinks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whereas Mestral, I can picture him at some point staying behind. He probably ran for elected office or something.
He probably did.
Probably ran for president.
Right?
Yeah. Getting way too into it.
You know, that comes... I'm sorry, the differences between them do boil down as well to the Vulcan attitude toward lying. And mm-hmm. these are kind of proto-Vulcans compared to what we know on Star Trek, of course. But Tamir doesn't lie all that much. And, like, one of the first opportunities she has to lie in the episode, she doesn't. You know, we had an accident with our vehicle
exactly.
outside your town.
Yep.
That's not a lie.
I love it.
It's not a lie. It's you know? True. It's completely so true.
Awesome.
But she does lie later, which was yes. interesting mm-hmm. to me. Well, she lies more than once, right? But the big one is when she tells the Vulcan rescue team yeah. that Mestral died in the crash.
Yes, but after she's had her change, after her her character right. change has occurred.
And that's the interesting moment where, okay, well, T'Pol told them, well, this is all in the history books, just nobody from Earth reads it because it's a much better story to tell the thing in Bozeman where there's the statue. But that's all in the history books, but the story she tells is not in the history books. This is something that's been passed down in her family. This is something not widely known, and it's actually really fascinating for her character that she tells Trip and Archer about this. It sort of reminds me, there's not a good parallel, but this is similar to the episode where Neelix tells the ghost story to the Borg children. And
yeah.
sort of at the right. end of it, he doesn't tell them for sure whether or not it was a story. And I think we as the audience are pretty sure that this is exactly what happened. But in the actual scene, it's sort of left nebulous so that Archer and Trip don't go back and tell everyone yeah. to go back and look and see. Because it would probably look very bad that Tamir had lied. And such a huge lie would cause ripples, I think.
So we think that's T'Pol's intention behind leaving it in that way, because then she goes back to recorders and she unwraps her grandmother's purse, and mm-hmm. we have that moment like, ooh, at least some of it was true. But then I was left wondering, why would you then leave it in such a strange, as you say, Greg, nebulous place with Trip and Captain Archer? And is it
maybe she just likes to screw with Archer?
Probably does. The least likable first officer in Star Trek history.
Right.
Yeah. That may
they
be
served
so.
Her steak once, right? So
oh, that's
she's
right.
still pissed yeah. about that.
Yeah. She really what? Doesn't like their odor.
I think she is. I think she's concerned for her family name. That
sure.
yeah.
you know, it's a cover up to some extent. And Vulcans, they live a long time. They have long memories. This is not that old of news. And
no, it's not.
I mean, I don't think he's alive, but I wouldn't be surprised, honestly, if there's descendants of Mistral on Earth somewhere.
Of Mistral and what's her name?
Yeah, and what's her name?
Maggie.
Is Maggie?
Well, he said he was going to leave Carbon Creek, though, and he was going to go to one of their larger cities, and then who knows where?
Who knows? Well, right. We'll That's see. Right. I've seen people say that before, and then they end up sticking around and marrying the girl. But I just,
that's
I mean,
a good
that's,
point.
Yeah. So I know I do think T'Pol was trying to protect her ancestors and do and yeah, leave it nebulous. And I think that's really fascinating that she has this big secret that's been passed down in her family.
So I guess I was going to come to this at the end, but we would just put it out now. I think all three of us feel that this story actually did happen, that this was first contact between humans and Vulcans.
Right. Well, and this is the big difference between this episode and, was it 1159? Well, I guess it's not that big a difference, but that's the episode where Janeway sort of tells the story, or we see the story at least, of her ancestor on Earth. And we learn that sort of the story Janeway's been told was completely false. And the actual story was completely different and did not paint her ancestor in such a beautiful light.
So you're saying Janeway's a big liar, basically.
No, well, Janeway, I think, didn't know, right? It's been a while since I saw that episode.
I know, I got to rewatch that one myself. That might be one of those ones where I tuned in for 5 minutes like, oh, it's a Janeway episode.
I haven't watched that one in a long time either, but that's where they're building the, is it called the Millennium Gate?
That's
is
right.
That right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. It's you know, building up to the Millennium, and it's in some small town. It's actually very similar to this episode if you go back and watch it. And it's another one of those things where we're not sure exactly what the truth is. And it's an interesting comment on history, that it is so easy for the history book to say something that isn't true.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And that's what this Carbon Creek is like for me, too. Mm-hmm. Now, they didn't put Kramer in charge of building the Millennium Gate, right? Because it would have been built a year early, I think, right?
Chris, go ahead.
So, Michael, you said this also reminds you of North Star a bit, I believe. Is
yeah,
that just because of the aesthetics of it, or is it because of a part of the story element?
Yeah, I thought it was originally because of they had similar aesthetics. So I watched Carbon Creek, and then I said, well, this reminds me so much of another story on Enterprise, I have to go back and watch the other one, because I get the two confused, or I used to. And so I watched North Star, which is the episode of Enterprise where they go and find the colony full of humans that were abducted in the 1850s. By aliens to build their colonies. And, you know, and it's Enterprise's Wild West story. What did you guys say? It's the Enterprise version of Spectre of the Gun?
Yeah, well, yeah, it's it was first titled A Fistful of T'Pol's.
Yes. Well, I watched that one, and, you know, they're very, very different episodes, and I think you can see the that one was done later. That was done in the middle of the third season, and Carbon Creek here is, this is season two, right?
Yep. Second episode of season two.
Yeah. So you can see, you can actually, it's fun to watch the aging of Enterprise if you watch these back to back because the other one is just, there are stronger decisions made in almost every element of the storytelling.
Interesting.
I mean, it's shot strangely. It's cast with, it's a much more menacing story. It's, you know, at this point we have the Makos and we have a whole bunch of stuff, but really ultimately it's a very, very different episode, but it is fun to watch Enterprise grow across just the span of a single season. But it is also funny to see what problems remain, and that episode is another one that, if it wanted to, could have been 35 minutes long.
Hmm.
Like, the pacing on Enterprise was just so consistently slow that and I sat there, and I wondered, am I the only one who thinks this? Hmm. Let me ask the person sitting next to me, who is not a Star Trek fan, who's just watching TV with me. It's my roommate, and she's just like, yeah, no, this is... I like it, but I'm falling asleep. Yeah. You know, just being kind of carried along, led by the hand down a road at a very gentle pace on a balmy day.
Well, there's an interesting thing that this is another episode similar to the one, I think it was actually last time you were on the show, where we talked about regeneration, right? At least we did talk about that recently. And it's another show where there's really just an A story. Not so much a B story. It's one story thread pushing us through. Somehow that show moves forward so fast. You never sit down, you never stop to think that you're bored. This episode, you feel like it needs like so much more. And I don't know what it could be. I think part of the problem is every time there's an issue, it's resolved by the next commercial break. You know, there's the cave-in, and they just go in and fix it. What's his name? Can't go to college. So T'Pol sells Velcro. Like, why can't those be like episode-long arcs? You know, why can't the cave-in be like this big deal that, you know, the whole town comes together, they have to fix it? I don't know. I'm not there breaking the story, but I feel like it's missing, you know, real danger. You know, they're never in, you know, once they get over themselves and go down to town, there's no more danger for anyone. And that's a big problem for your characters.
Well, I don't think that the reason for writing this episode was never to put those Vulcans in danger. Mm-hmm. They weren't going to be rescued. It was an opportunity to... This is another episode, I think, where Star Trek's talking about itself a lot, though.
Yeah.
And it's why I was saying, if you can get past the you know, the similarities to the city on the edge of forever, with the clothes and the hat and the bar and the soup kitchen and all this kind of stuff, and even here, Michael, a bit of the pacing, because, yeah, I know what you mean. There are some of these scenes that just kind of go on and on. Mm-hmm. I mean, the pool scene is an example that just... The pool scene did not need to be that long in order to make the point that he can play pool and they can get some money and they can go buy some TV dinners, right?
Yeah, they let the second unit director just go wild shooting pool shots. I don't know. Let's rack the focus from the left like pocket
Moscone,
to the middle.
Please,
we'll rack it back 25% and then we'll zoom in on his eyes and then sort of do it. Like, no, we just have him shoot pool and cut to the next scene.
Like, listen, we brought in this pool expert for $500 an hour. We are going to show his shots. I'm getting my money's worth.
I need to go check the DVD box set on the special features disc. There might be like 20 minutes of cut footage from the pool that didn't make it in the episode.
I mean, on the Enterprise DVD, they have the pool choreographer's commentary track, which now it makes sense, you know.
Oh, check out this bank shot coming up here. Yeah, look at this. Oh, side pocket shot. Very difficult.
Very
sound
true.
Editor drops in
the and I should also point out that this episode does have a B plot. The B plot is Archer refilling the wine glasses. I like the fact that T'Pol didn't want wine at first. She was going to have a little bit. And then halfway through the story, Archer's filling her glass back up. So.
Go ahead, Greg.
Sorry. I want to get back to what Chris was talking about. But they did... apparently have an alternate version of the end of the story in which they all were drunk. Like they played it kind of straight in this one, but apparently as scripted, there was an alternate version where they were just completely plastered on wine by the end of it, which I had several glasses of wine last night and I absolutely understand how that can be.
Oh, that's a good feeling right there. I don't know what you're talking about though, Greg. That was the aired episode. I was just going to say, did you see the makeup job on Trip and Captain Archer? Watch their faces get redder as the episode goes on.
I don't know
if that's intentional,
like it, but yeah,
they have
there.
Got, oh man, they are feeling warm and toasty on whatever the hell that red wine is. That was awesome.
Oh, great.
They do get redder. They really do.
Oh, but what I was saying, though, about this being like Star Trek talking about itself is that what we typically see in Star Trek, when it comes to social commentary, it's usually a one-sided argument. And it's usually that humans of the 20th century, or now for us the 21st century, are violent.
Yeah.
We can't tolerate those who are not like us. We're on a road to self-destruction. It's just, we're bad. Everything about us is bad, bad, bad.
Even Picard agrees with Q. You know, Q's like, humans in 1987 are horrible savages. And Picard's like, yes, they are. Aren't humans in 1987 the worst?
They're the worst.
Yes, it's true.
Yeah. So, but that's what you usually get. And in this episode, that's the position that Tamir takes, and especially that Strawn takes. And as the episode goes on, Tamir softens up a little bit, but Strawn never does. But what you have that's unique in here is that on the flip side, you have Mistral arguing the opposite, arguing that there are all these good qualities to humans of the 20th century.
Hmm.
And they have compassion, you know, and they haven't reached their potential yet, but there are all these good things that you can see in them. if you stop for a minute and look. And that's something that we rarely see in Star Trek when they talk about us.
Yeah.
And as we've talked about in some other episodes, you know, DS9 did this a lot, where DS9 would talk about Star Trek and would contradict the principles that you typically think of when it comes to Star Trek social commentary. And then here in this episode of Enterprise, we've actually got both sides going at each other. And I think that's what the point of the whole script was. And that's why there is no real danger. That's why when the sink leaks, it gets fixed quickly. And when the explosion happens in the mine, Mistral saves them quickly. And I especially agree that when T'Pol finds out, of course, we don't know how, well, I guess we do, because they were going to be rescued in 3 days. So when T'Pol finds out that Jack doesn't have money for college, she quickly gets the Velcro and goes sells the Velcro. You know, these things are just resolved so easily, because if the whole episode was about rescuing miners from the cave-in, it would be a completely different story.
Yeah, I would lose something. I agree. And it's nice to see Star Trek does often talk about humanity's potential, and it doesn't do it in specifics. You hear aliens talking about old humans, they have such potential, or even 24th century humans. It's like, well, you're not terribly interesting yet, but we will keep an eye on you because you will grow into something interesting. But that's rarely quantified. And in this episode, you have the Mistral basically just out and saying, she's like, well, what potential? What are you talking about? And he's like, yeah, empathy, compassion. Mm. They have a profound sense of being able to feel for one another. And that's cool. You know, and that's Star Trek doesn't say that very often. And when they do get specific in Next Generation times, usually it's not empathy. It's adaptability.
Yeah.
That's what it's stylish to call humans. They're adaptable. They can adapt to any situation. But to hear something like empathy and compassion called out, particularly in the 50s.
Yeah.
In 1950s North America, I mean, that's fascinating. In one light, it's, you know, contrary to what you expect, but also it's like, oh yeah, no, that's cool. You know, when the Vulcans, and what's her rebuttal to that? Only because they think we're human.
Mm.
If we weren't human, do you think they would be as kind and as compassionate, as empathetic? And I thought and you guys may not agree with me, but I thought maybe there was a missed opportunity there to...
Hmm.
If they wanted to say a little more about that, they could have actually even said, not only because we appear to be human, but only because we're white also.
Mm.
This was not an era known for its compassion toward everyone and equality for everyone, you know? I don't know. I feel like they could have gone a little deeper with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's also, I'm going to draw a parallel here to Battlestar Galactica.
So say we all.
Where, if you watch have you heard of it? Battlestar Galactica, it's a great show.
So say we all.
2004, 2010.
The new one. Oh.
But the TV movie The Plan has these two Cylons, the Brother Cavils, and one of them goes to live with humans on the post-apocalyptic Caprica, and the other lives with humans in the fleet. And the one on Caprica that lives with the humans, deals with on a daily basis, comes to realize what the other Cavils have been missing. That, yes, humans have this, it's weird, they have this crazy love, this empathy, this something that makes them actually special. Mm-hmm. And that's something this show predated it by, you know, a good 10 years in saying that. It's great to hear that, you know, and it's a way of saying... You know, not only are we awesome, you know, humans are in fact awesome, but it's a way of saying, what is the best part of ourselves? Why do we, you know, Adama asks, why do we deserve to survive? And I feel like it's an exploration of why humans do deserve to survive. In the same way, Encounter at Farpoint, Picard was making the argument for why humans have a right to be out in space. You know, some of it is us just puffing ourselves up and saying, yes, we are amazing. But there are good qualities. There are things inside of humanity that if we would work on them, if we would improve them, if we would make them the primary aspects of our lives, of our culture, we would advance so much as a civilization. And when Star Trek is saying that, when Battlestar Galactica was saying that, that's when it's at its best.
I agree.
Yeah, yeah. And I think in this case, like you said, Michael, with T'Pol, I think I do agree with her as well, that it's only because they think we're human. Because if they had known that they were aliens, then definitely, you know, the government would have taken them in.
Pitchforks and start the fires.
Experiments on them and find out. They would be interrogated. And you make a good point, too, about it's because they're white, you know, or they are more or less white. And
kind of greenish, to be honest.
Kind of greenish, but they're not black. And that's the thing in that time period.
Well, but at the same time, even in, what was it, past tense? We see Bashir and Sisko deal with the exact same thing, and that was a good 100 years in the future.
Yeah, that's in the 21st, early 21st century, and you still feel that, like, because Sisko is black, that there is some discrimination still at that point. But I think that the core of Mestral's argument, though, it transcends, you know, race and all, because, I mean, if you look at the United States today, just white people themselves can't get along with each other. Yes. I mean, there's so much division about silly religious things, this silly political and ideological thing. It's become beyond ridiculous. Yeah. And but so to pull that out and say, but yes, there is, you know, compassion or empathy, or where they have the potential to pull together, is still a valid argument, even without the whole whether they're aliens or what race they are.
Well, one thing that's interesting to me about this episode is that it's not a time travel story. They're not looking at the 50s through the lens of, well, we know what humans are like in 400 years. They're just saying, this is what humans are like. This is humanity.
Yeah.
Do they have potential at this point? And that's an interesting thing to look at us right now. And I think this is something I want to ask you guys. Do you think we have this potential? You know, we're arguing in politics right now over whether or not, you know, birth control should be available to people. You know, we're arguing about the stupidest things. Do we have the potential to make it, to get to the Star Trek future, to be acceptable to people like the Vulcans? Or are we stuck in this horrible cycle that we've been in for, you know, 200 years?
Well, I think we have the potential. I'm not sure that we have the leadership or the will to see that potential through. I mean, it's definitely there. I think, you know, we're in a situation where we have a terrible economy. This is the thing. I mean, it all comes down to money. It's like, if money didn't matter, then you could achieve so many more things in the world. You know, there are plenty of people who want to do the right thing, who want to help. I mean, you look at people who are starving in different parts of the world. There are plenty of people who want to solve that problem, but it's always a matter of resources. And, you know, the things that are being bickered about around the world right now, some of the laws that are being put in place and all, it's so short-sighted. It's like there are all these big picture, bigger things that need to be dealt with. But it's like humanity right now. We would rather sink down into petty disagreements instead of actually trying to solve any of these problems. So I think the potential is there, but I definitely worry about our ability to make it through these problems, because it feels like the whole civilization right now is starting to crumble. It really feels that way. And when you have tough economic times like this, what you so often see is you see like people retreat back into kind of religious zealotry, and you really see that happening in a lot of places around the world right now. And the U.S. is one of the really big ones, but it's not the only one. It's happening in all sorts of places all around the world. Yeah. And it like goes hand in hand when you have this economic problem. And that kind of thing will definitely hold us back from reaching that Star Trek future, like you're asking.
Yeah, I watched this film, Margin Call, that was produced by Zachary Quinto. And it's all about the collapse of the mortgage-backed securities market. And it's done from the perspective of those traders and traders with a D and their involvement and how they dealt with it. And there's an interesting sort of monologue in the middle of it where a guy explains, you know, we are necessary for the culture to exist, for the economy to exist. You know, people want to have nice cars, big houses, everything they want. And for the economy to surge forward and all this stuff to exist, we have to exist. And it's absolutely true. Like, they yeah. aren't the bad guys. The bad guys are us who are wanting to have this economy where we've got, you know, 20% growth every quarter. You know, it's not reasonable. It's not what we should be aiming for. You know, what we need to be aiming for is advancements in the science, in the sciences, yes. in the humanities. We need to be making sure people aren't starving. Like, why do we care if the economy is growing, if unemployment is still up? You know, why do we care yeah. if someone can buy a gigantic house on credit when there are children starving? Like, I, just not to make it all culture wars, I don't think that's what it is. I think it's about who we want to be as humans and how far we are from that even being our goal from day to day.
You communist bastard.
I know. I'm sorry. I'm getting on a soapbox again. I did this on past tense again. So I'm going to step off my soapbox. Yeah. I'm going to allow Michael Fisher
to speak. I love it. No. I think, and this is something I have not thought about before, but Star Trek tends to treat all races as kind of as unified because, you know, by the time of Star Trek, of most of the action of Star Trek, all these races have come together. They've overcome their differences and humans are one of them. But I think for that, you know, I hope that happens. But the scale of even one of these races that we're familiar with dealing with in Star Trek is so vast.
Mm-hmm.
And the scale of humanity right now is vast at almost 7 billion. Did we cross over to 7 billion, by the way? Are we there?
I think so.
Getting close, yeah.
Okay, but in any case, almost 7 billion or 7 billion.
Yeah.
And it is perfectly exemplified by a line in this episode. Right after T'Pol and T'Pol's foremother. What's her name?
Tamir.
Right after Tamir and Mistral wander into town, she says, it's hard to believe these people capable of launching an artificial satellite.
Mm.
And it's so true.
Yeah.
I mean, this is not only the planet that launched an artificial satellite, but it is they're in a country that is about to launch a very similar one. I mean, you know, it's the culture is technologically capable of it at this point, but they are in a town where the primary form of income of most people is going down into the ground to get rock, to get coal, you know, to get minerals, and where leaving for college, leaving for a higher education is kind of a really rare thing. But this is the same planet. It's not just the same planet. It's the same country, you know, that has spacefaring technology. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's amazing. If you look at it from that, on that micro level, the differences between the different classes on this planet are such that, you know, I think parts of humanity have that potential to get back to the question that was asked 15 minutes ago, but I don't think all of humanity does. And I think if humanity does unify, then there will have to be significantly fewer of us after a large global conflict. Mm. You're welcome for the uplifting thoughts.
We're going to start talking about the eugenics wars again.
Yes.
Oh, gosh. But Greg, yeah, and what you're saying there is, though, I would not say that we are the bad guys or the brokers are the bad guys or the government are the bad guys. It's everybody combined. There has to be balance. And that's what we don't have in the world right now is we don't have balance. Yeah. There's all this... Michael called you a communist bastard. It's funny because that's what you see now in the U.S. Mm-hmm. It's like, if you're not in favor of unchecked runaway capitalism, then you're communist.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're in favor of helping people when they need medical care or they can't find a job, you're socialist or you're communist. It's like, it doesn't work that way. It's not how the world works.
Right, it's not black and white. It's not
the world is not black and white. Well, you have to have balance.
And if you're not in favor of universal health care, and if you're in favor of war, you're a fascist. It's like, it's all of this. Like we never sit down and talk about like the important issues and figure out how we can, as a culture, what are the things we agree are important, what we need to be working on. We can only agree on what we can argue about.
We spend
so much time arguing about those things that we miss the bigger picture of what we can be doing to advance society.
Right. Now, you understand, Michael, here that Greg has stolen a script from the next J.J. Abrams movie, which features Q, and he's actually reciting the lines from the court scene in the next movie.
Oh, very nice. No, that would be awesome if that were redone, by the way. I would pay to see Encounter at Firepoint redone with a court scene that addresses our modern problems. I think that would be fantastic. Really,
but Michael, you also pointed out that Carbon Creek, the town, you know, no one leaves to go to college. It's like the fact that Jack wants to leave, he's like an anomaly in this town.
Yeah.
But he also represents the potential that Mestral's talking about.
Very much so.
Everyone else is where humanity is right now, whereas Jack represents that next step. He wants to break free from that and go to university and improve life.
Yes. And Jack is Star Trek's golden child. I feel like Jack is the person that Star Trek loves to talk about because characters like Jack are the only reason that anything like Star Trek will ever be possible.
Right.
And I feel like Star Trek does occasionally like to go back to this particular time period of the space race because it is the only time in history so far that space travel has been cool. Like, I mean, if you weren't necessarily ostracized if you were a kid who wanted to go work for NASA because why NASA was cool? Because they put someone on the frickin' moon.
Yeah.
And, you know, in our lifetimes, in most of our lifetimes, that has not happened. I have, in my lifetime, we have not set foot on another celestial body. You know, that sucks, because we could have by now, 100 times over. But,
well,
you know,
we could have a colony on Mars by now.
If we wanted to, absolutely.
But we have to build fighter jets and tanks, and all the money has to go there. I mean, a fraction of that money could find a colony on Mars, but
absolutely,
it's not important.
But it's not important anymore because we don't have to beat the other guy anymore.
Right.
Because we're a bunch of competitive douches.
But to get to that Star Trek future, at some point, that stuff has to matter.
Yes.
Or else we'll never get there.
Yeah.
Right. And I think the only thing that what's going to drive us there is a population problem. But I mean, you know, who knows?
Yeah, well, we'll see about that. Yeah, but we are so focused on making sure we can win the next war that we're not trying to figure out how we can actually make it so there's no reason to have war at all. And that's where we need to get to. And I don't know where it comes from. I don't know how it happens. Star Trek postulates, that there's a huge world war ahead of us. Still
that is
to come.
So terrible that is, I guess, what makes humans realize that we can't do this anymore.
Yeah.
Right. There has to be this one more big war.
I feel like, well, and we're doing like speculative future casting, right? But I feel like what the Third World War does is set us on another cycle of like despair and death and then rebuilding. And our attitudes are still the same until First Contact happens. I feel like First Contact is the inciting incident that brings humanity together.
Yeah.
At least if you listen to Counselor Deaf Lady.
Well, and then, okay, so now if you haven't seen the end of Battlestar, go ahead and stop listening and skip forward.
Drink.
But, Michael, you're okay? I'm not going to spoil this for anyone. The way
that would be me.
Okay, well, I'm sorry, Chris. But the way they solve this problem is, okay, mass catastrophe, you know, the silence come, destroy humanity, the last dregs of humanity leave, and eventually they destroy their technology and just go back and start the cycle anew and go back to having nothing at all. And that's a dark, dark future. I mean, it's hopeful. It's like, oh, wow, there is hope at the end of the tunnel. But it's not, oh, the Vulcans came and we were friends and we did space travel. It's technology and culture gets to a point where it just cannot sustain itself. And you just have to reset everything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there are cultures on Earth that have myths that this has happened before. You know, that there have been cycles in the world. And so.
And that plays right into how we feel about stuff. Like when you get completely fed up with something and you cannot handle it anymore, I mean, and everything has gone wrong and your house of cards has collapsed on you. I mean, what's the easiest thing to do? Wipe off that table and start over again. I mean, this is a very cultural thing.
All right. Well, as you can see, Carbon Creek gives an opportunity to delve into a lot of issues for a show from that crappy Enterprise series that fans talk about. But so why don't we sum up then just with just final thoughts on how you feel about the episode as an episode of Star Trek, and if there's any other point about it that you want to make that we haven't talked about yet. What about you, Greg?
Well, we haven't mentioned yet the new lighter jumpsuits that they created for season 2, which I think look very spiffy.
What?
I believe they're used in this episode, right? They sort of slightly changed the uniforms coming out of
the season finale.
Yeah. Yep.
Like lighter fabric or lighter
shade?
Yeah,
it's like slightly lighter fabric. Yeah.
For real?
Yeah. Now you're not talking about the silk pajamas, are you?
And that was my next thing. It was this. My outro was all about costuming. The silk pajamas of T'Pol. I mean, where can I buy those? Because I want every girl I'm ever with to be able to wear those silk pajamas.
Do you want every girl you're ever with to be as cold and unlikable as Jolene Blaylock?
Oh, have you met my ex-girlfriends, Mike?
Burn. Nice.
Oh, man. But she may be cold and unlikable, but there's something in that.
Yeah.
She's got this kind of, Tamir has this kind of sultry nature to her.
You guys are masochists. I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, I like with the silk pajamas that they, although in the scene, they're supposed to be showing you that she's carrying the bag.
Right.
I like that she carries the bag just in the right position so that they can just frame her from like her navel down to like, you know, just her upper thighs and then hold that as she walks across the room.
It's the only thing that was keeping this crew interested
that,
after.
That woke you up at the end of the episode.
Right.
Is that what
that was?
I stopped playing with Siri.
Right.
For a minute I were playing with Siri. What is a Vulcan?
All right.
I'm sorry.
Well, anything else, Greg, that you
No, that's about it. What are your final thoughts, Mike, as I continue to try to stay off of my soapbox for the rest of the episode?
Oh, your soapbox is an interesting one. Now I have a soapbox too, and it's about little minutia like pacing and lighting and camera angles and being bored and scripts and miscasting and all this kind of stuff. For all that stuff, you put all that stuff aside. This is a cute, kitschy episode of Star Trek, but it is fundamentally what Star Trek is about. There's equal parts fun and kind of adorable and adventuresome and philosophical. You know, they done good.
Yeah, I would agree. For me, it's about that too. It's the social commentary element, which is what I look for most in Star Trek. I like the fact that in this episode, they're arguing both sides, as I said. And, you know, there are the elements where they're just lifting from other episodes. I felt like maybe they shouldn't have made the thing with the clothes, stealing the clothes and the, you know, the hat and all quite so close to what happened in the City on the Edge of Forever, because it does make it hard, I think, for some fans. But at the same time, you could look at that like it's an homage. They have the line in there when Maggie kisses Mestral, and he says it was very pleasant.
Very pleasant.
She says pleasant. Yeah, I did say very
that
pleasant.
Was a
it's
cute
like
scene.
Worf and Troy in All Good Things when they come off from the stroll.
Very stimulating.
Yes. So, but it's a fun one. I think it's one of Enterprise's better episodes, personally. Even though I would agree that the pacing is slow, but it's a good message, and I just love the fact that there's this unknown thing in the history of the Federation and of humanity that no one knew about, but it's there, because I have a feeling that there are a lot of those things both in the Star Trek history and in our own history, and so the episode works well for me. And as I said as we were talking, I think that the story is true, and it did happen, even though she leaves Tripp and Archer hanging there. All right, well, let's head on out. So before we go, Michael, tell everyone where they can find you around the web.
Absolutely. I am tweeting often and about strange and interesting things at Fats Riker Beard. Is this the one? Is this the one where you guys find out what the story is, or no?
Okay.
Greg's got to go.
No, I will hold on to hear the story of the Fats Riker Beard.
I moved to Boston after an extended period in Virginia, and I was 25, and I quit smoking.
Oh.
And I got a job where I could suddenly afford to eat out all the time, and I went from a retail position running around to sitting in a sound booth for 8 hours a day. So this combination of factors led to me putting on something like 15 pounds in a month or two.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And I got cast in a show, and I grew a beard for the show, and I really looked a lot like Jonathan Frakes after season five or so, season six. So my castmate and I made up a character called Fats Riker Beard. And I would go around town doing absurd Riker-like things, and after which I would say, "That's Fats," and run away. So that's how that came about. No insult, certainly, to my hero, Jonathan Frakes, but that's where that nickname came about. So I've since lost that weight.
And you've lost the beard.
I have lost the beard for the moment, yes. I'm playing another part that doesn't require it, so I'm season one Riker at the moment. And Greg, for anyone who doesn't know, has taken my beard.
So now you're sans Riker beard. You should change your Twitter name.
I'm sans Riker beard, yeah. Yeah, Greg, your beard is rocking. I hope that you guys have been talking about it. Everyone should look at Greg's beard if they can. It's great.
I'm a big fan of my beard. Thank you.
You should be. You're not the only one, buddy.
Michael has not plugged his other venture. Not only on Twitter, where else can you be found, Michael?
Yes, I've recently got a job writing for a website called pocketnow.com, and I write about tablets and other consumer technology, so you can find me over there if you're interested in such things, and when I am not doing that, I will continue writing for the Living in the Future series, which is gathering about an inch and a half of dust, and Chris is very benevolently, gently bothering me about that. Thank you for the shout out. And actually also, my mobile phone's alternate self can be found on Twitter at Captain2Phones. And that's that. So thanks for having me again, guys.
Thank you very much
for joining us. Well, Greg, thanks for indulging me wanting to discuss Carbon Creek for our Enterprise show this week.
Yeah, it's weird remembering that Enterprise is 10 years old at this point. I mean, it didn't finish until 2005, but this episode was September 2002, which is just astonishing for me to think about because it still feels like the new show. But it's great because now so much time has passed that these are episodes I can go back to, look at them sort of out of context and see, you know, the good and the bad. You know, how does this compare to Time Zero, to Fistful of Data's, to City on the Edge of Forever? Does it hold up? Is it to that level? And I don't know about you guys, but I think it's at least in the canon. It's worthy of consideration. It's not perfect. But of course, the original series had pacing issues too. So I think it's up there. It is worthy of people going back and saying, you know, this is what Enterprise could have been. It's actually what Enterprise was.
Yeah, I think it's a good example of Enterprise, even though most of the crew doesn't appear in the episode.
That's true.
They saved a lot of money, I guess, by not having the rest of the crew in.
It feels like a bottle episode, but I guess they spend a lot of money going on location or shooting in the backlot or whatever they did. It wasn't cheap, so I guess they saved money by not ever having to light the bridge set.
Yeah, well, they had to pay for that wine, too. That was some really good wine that they were drinking there. If you saw the label.
Very nice one.
All right, Greg. Well, let's tell everyone where they can find us if they want to share their thoughts. You can, of course, go to trek.fm/contact, and you can send us a text message through there. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm and on Google+ at hyperchannel/trekfmg+. And then, of course, you can find us on Twitter, which is where most people hit us up because they're talking about Star Trek pretty much around the clock, and that's at twitter.com/TrekFM, username TrekFM. And Greg, everyone can find you on Twitter as well.
That's right. I am on Twitter at Greg Harbin, GREGHARBIN. I will no longer be talking about Battlestar Galactica because I finished my hashtag BSG2012 this afternoon when I watched the plan as I discussed. The thing is, I now have Capricorn to watch, so it never ends.
Okay. I was going to ask you if you picked a new show because I need to know what kind of sound clip I've got a source here. So, so it's going to be Caprica, but Caprica is very short, right? Did it even make it through one season?
No, actually, Caprica is two whole seasons.
Oh wow!
And
that's doing really good for sci-fi these days, right?
And I haven't even seen the second season, so I'm hoping I can get through Caprica. And then Blood and Chrome, which is the new series, which is coming soon, hopefully, as long as I can not talk about it too much on the show.
Well, now you predicted on a previous Ready Room that Blood and Chrome would never be released.
Well, but I...
Now, are you going back on that now?
I'm going back because in Seattle, 2 or 3 weeks ago, there was a Battlestar extravaganza. I forget what it was called, but there's a... I always forget the name of this place, but there's been a Battlestar exhibit in Seattle for the past 6 months to a year. And when they finished the exhibit, they had this big whole thing. And all these actors from the show came down. Glenn Campbell, the costume designer, came. And also Bear McCreary, who did the music for the actual series. And he said at this event that he just finished the score for Blood and Chrome. So there it is. It is still being worked on. We knew that Doug Drexler said they finished the effects, so here's the music being done. There's still no air date, but Battlestar Galactica, Blood and Chrome is coming. Again, if I can not talk about it on the show and get it canceled, that is still, yeah. Still a possibility.
Well, just keep in mind that even though there has been a score written, Sci-Fi can still cancel it 4 episodes
That's
in.
Very
just
true.
Remember, it's always a possibility. Okay, well, anyway, you can find me on Twitter as well. My username is cbrianjones. That's Brian with a Y. And you can also visit our website, trek.fm. You can find games and crosswords and feature articles and all kinds of stuff. We've got all these different shows going as well. And you can play Trek Trivia. And also, if you enjoy Trek Trivia, follow username Trek Trivia on Twitter, where you can find live quizzes several times a week. Well, Greg, I think that covers everything, so I'm going to go out. I've got to go and change into my silk pajamas for the rest of the day.
All right, Chris, I think it's time to stick a pool cue in it, because the Ready Room is done.
Okay.
All right.
Oh, Michael loved that one.
Thank you, Michael.
I thought you were gonna do Velcro. That
was
awesome.
I was, but I changed up on you.
That's improv, man. That was great.
Thank you. Thank you.